Track 8, Substituting Self-Control for Self-Mutilation. On the last track, we discussed therapy hyper-nurturing. On this track, we will discuss self-control as it relates to a self-mutilating client. We'll discuss thinking and behaving in an age-appropriate manner, dissolving the excuse of catharsis, and de-associating the activity with frustration. I find in treating self-injurers that the best way to help self-mutilating teen clients cope with their situation is to find a way to think and behave in an age-appropriate manner. I aid clients to find age-appropriate alternatives to vent their feelings through the five areas of 1, education about control, 2, setting limits and boundaries, 3, enforcing consequences, 4, offering encouragement and praise, and 5, holding clients responsible for their actions. This last point of holding clients responsible or accountable, I find is key in their path to self-control. Sometimes those adolescent self-injurers who were hospitalized could have been treated as infants by the hospital staff. They could not have any sharp objects. Not only was this attempt futile, as any well-experienced self-injurer could find something with which to hurt themselves, it also gave the client an even deeper sense of loss of control. Angela, age 15, stated, "At the hospital, they treated me like I was a third grader. They took away the scissors and anything else I could possibly injure myself with. Instead of feeling in control, I started to rely on them to do the healing for me." Angela, by not being treated as a responsible adult, never learned self-control and therefore never learned to heal herself. When she was let out, so to speak, to the real world, Angela experienced moments of severe anxiety due to her inability to control her impulses. Make sense? Sure it does. To aid Angela relate to a way to self-control, I found reflective responses beneficial. It was important that Angela acknowledge both positive and negative traits and decided which ones enhanced her ability to function on her own and which ones cause difficulty. I ask Angela to answer the following questions, and incidentally, these questions are reprinted in the manual that accompanies this course for purposes of your reproduction and future session reference. 1, what am I like as a person emotionally, intellectually, in manner and behavior? 2, what roles do I play? How do I feel about them? For instance, as a student, daughter, son, sister, brother, etc. 3, what are my particular strengths and weaknesses as a person? Which characteristics do I want to change for sure? And which ones would I never change? 4, identify the patterns that repeat in the roles I play. To these, Angela answered, "As a person, I'm a little overactive. I tend to take everything personally, and I never let anything just go. I'm really, I guess you'd call, sort of neurotic about things like school and how I look. I try to establish myself as a leader. I'm class vice president because I thought people would think I'm really assertive and a go-getter. I work hard at everything I do, but sometimes I think I work too hard. I wish every little thing didn't affect me so much, and that the smallest disruption wouldn't tear my world down. However, I'm a very caring person, I think. I like to help people, and I don't like what I'm doing to my parents and family by injuring myself." By completing this exercise, Angela could focus on her strengths, such as a hard worker and devotion, and try to diffuse her weaknesses, such as hypersensitivity. Think of your Angela. Does he or she need an exercise to examine their strengths and weaknesses to increase their self-control? As you probably have observed in your own practice, many self-injurers use the excuse of catharsis to account for their self-mutilating actions. Many self-mutilating teens that hold this view tend to have grown up in a childhood home where anger was expressed through violence. This instilled into the self-injurer the idea that action must be taken to relieve that pressure. This is the reason I feel many clients start to self-injure, and for this reason many therapists recommend alternative methods to expel the anguish. However, in practice, I feel this sort of treatment actually leads to an escalation of self-injury. Angela was directed by a staff member during her hospitalization to dip her arm into a bucket of cold water. In doing this, she developed a treatment-resistance case of frostbite. When she was referred to me, I explained to Angela how this seemingly harmless act can be used to only further her preoccupation with self-injury. Do you agree? Sometimes clients are asked by their therapist to use exercise as a form of dispelling negative emotions. Many of these clients told me that when they used physical activity, they felt over-anxious and their feelings of frustration actually increased afterwards, causing them to intensify their self-injury. Sylvia, age 19, would punch a bag to release her emotional stress. I explained to Sylvia that the only real effective way to keep her from self-injuring was to stop associating emotions with an action. Self-control, I told her, is going to keep you from cutting yourself, not constantly bringing yourself back to a violent action when you need to vent. Let me repeat that sentence again for you. I explained to Sylvia that the only real effective way to keep her from self-injuring is to stop associating emotions with an action. Self-control, I told her, is going to keep you from cutting yourself, not constantly bringing yourself back to a violent action when you need to vent. Sylvia, in self-injuring, was searching for a way to release the emotions she felt were going to make her explode. Instead of expressing these emotions through violent actions, I suggested to Sylvia that she try the Anger Inside Me exercise. The purpose of this exercise is to help Sylvia better understand her anger so she could develop the ability to manage and tolerate it effectively. These questions are also reproduced in your manual. I asked Sylvia to answer these questions. Number 1. What situations seem to evoke your anger most frequently? Number 2. What does becoming angry feel like? What kinds of thoughts arise once you're aware that you're angry? Are you afraid of others seeing you angry? Number 3. What do you need to learn about handling your anger? In response, Sylvia answered, I get frustrated when things don't go my way. My mother yells at me, my grade was bad on a test, or something somebody said to me just keeps replaying in my head. When I'm under these stresses, I tend to be very sensitive to react. When I burst, I think, that's it, I need a break. I need to get this stuff out. I'm okay with people seeing me angry. In fact, I like it because then they ask me what's wrong, and I like feeling that they care enough about me to stop what they're doing and take an interest. I need to learn that my anger does not need activity. It just needs to be accepted and turned into something positive, not violent. I need to figure out what sets me off. By identifying the specific triggers to her anger, Sylvia could better understand how these led to her self-injury. Viewing her angry feelings with sympathy and acceptance helped contribute to Sylvia's self-esteem and her control over her impulses. On this track, we discussed how self-control is essential in treating self-mutilating clients. We discussed thinking and behaving in an age-appropriate manner, dissolving the excuse of catharsis, and de-associating activity with frustration, which results in self-mutilation. On the next track, we'll discuss the various mental disorders with which adolescent self-mutilators are diagnosed. These include Axis 1, disorders such as depression, thought disorder, anxiety disorders, and post-traumatic stress disorder, and the Axis 2 disorder of borderline personality disorder. Question 8. What is one key question that needs to be answered to better analyze anger in your self-injuring client?